You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. That's a little Skype call, and now joining me is Grant Newsham. So, Grant, first of all, good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. I can't hear you very well.
How about that?
Okay, that's good.
The music was killing it. So, first of all, Grant, good morning. How are you? We're just so you know, we're on the air right now. So, early morning in Hawaii. How's the weather in Hawaii?
I think it's good. It's outside. Yeah, it'll be good today.
All right. First of all, Grant, our listeners have met you before, but for those people who don't know you, you've spent much of your career in Japan. You know the language and the customs, and so when things happen in the Pacific, we normally turn to you for some kind of assistance, lots of times explaining things. So tell everybody what you do, though, professionally these days.
What I am is sort of a defense commentator, mostly on Asian defense matters, really from Korea over to India. I'm associated with an outfit in Tokyo called the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies. So I'm sort of like a combination George Will and Al Sharpton and Bill O'Reilly of Asian defense.
You better hope you're not. Good God, that's an awful combination.
Okay, I get carried away sometimes.
All right. Well, let's. I want to kind of go through the basics and then talk about things beyond the basics. So, for people that might be listening to this subject for the first time, can you explain the dynamic in the Pacific right now? Explain North Korea if you can. Explain their relationship and the dynamic between South Korea, Japan, and China. So can you just give us a general overview or the general situation, if you will?
Okay, well, I'll give it a shot. Right. Well, North Korea, I think most people probably have some idea that it's out there, is just a horrific communist dictatorship. Run by the Kim family. It has many of the earmarks of an organized crime group, actually. It's hard to describe just how, say, horrific it is in the way it abuses its people. And it just has an absolute reign of terror going. And this has been going on for decades. In the more recent era, from about 25 years ago, the North Korean regime, led by, once again, the Kim family, now it's Kim Jong-un, but back then it was Kim Il-sung, has been trying to get nuclear weapons. And it has also, at the same time, been trying to develop missiles. And putting it simply, it wants missiles that can go anywhere in the world, intercontinental missiles. It wants to miniaturize the nuclear weapons so it can put those on the missiles. And that gives it an ace in the hole. Once it sees it has missiles, good missiles, nuclear weapons, then it reckons it's safe. And it's been on this steady move to get it, to get this technology. The Iranians have helped, the Chinese have helped, the Syrians have helped, and vice versa. And it now has nuclear weapons. It has missiles that the technology gets better and better. And this was just an engineering problem now before it gets intercontinental ballistic missiles with nuclear weapons on top that can go wherever they want and hit whatever they want. And so what's been going on is led by the United States, particularly the United States, but with Japan, South Korea joining in particular, they have been trying to come up with some combination of persuasion and pressure over the last 25 years that will keep North Korea from getting these weapons. They failed, ultimately, and U.S. Secretary of State basically said as much just a few weeks ago. Now, North Korea, to put it in simple terms, doesn't like the United States. It constantly refers to it as its main enemy, etc. So you've got this very dangerous country that now has, if it's just talk, that's one thing, but now it's got getting the weapons to actually do what it says it will, or at least have offered the threat of attacking America or attacking South Korea, attacking Japan. And that leads into their relationship with the Republic of Korea, South Korea. North Korea and South Korea are really still at war. They don't shoot much. Every now and then there's a shoot-up that the North Koreans do. South Korea has been pretty well behaved. But the two countries, as I said, are at war. The United States has troops and aircraft in South Korea. But within the South Korean population, you will find that there is a substantial chunk of it, particularly in the younger generations, but not exclusively, that actually sees the United States as kind of the problem. And the idea is if America would ease up or even leave, that the South Koreans and the North Koreans could reunify, because they do see themselves as ultimately the same people. So the dynamic in South Korea is a little bit complicated when it comes to North Korea, but ultimately they do see North Korea as a, by and large, as an enemy, and do keep in mind that the capital city of Seoul in South Korea is well within artillery and missile range of North Korean artillery and missiles just north of the border. It's only about 30 miles away. Now, throw Japan into the mix, and there's no even the South Koreans have sort of rough feelings towards Japan because Japan colonized the Korean Peninsula in the early about the first half of the 20th century. So there is this, it's very difficult relationship. There's mostly coming from the Korean side. Now the Japanese are far more willing to let bygones be bygones. But there has been some limited cooperation militarily between the Japanese and the South Korean militaries. Very limited, though. But it's there is some connection, and they don't. The militaries actually get along pretty well, but politically, Japan brings out the worst in the South Koreans, and the North Koreans hate the Japanese even more. So it's, and in all this, the United States is trying to get the South Koreans and the Japanese militaries to cooperate more, and also to create some political cooperation between the U.S., Japan, and South Korea. And then you have China here, and China has sort of in the way you would try to entice a dog with a dog bone, has been sort of hinting that it can actually get North Korea to behave and maybe even give up its nuclear weapons and missile programs. And they've been promising this for many years, and they've never delivered. And finally, on the U.S. side, there's some skepticism as to how much China really wants to rein in North Korea. And as we've talked about on other shows, underpinning all of this is China's effort to dominate really Asia, both militarily, economically, and politically. So there's sort of some competing movements and forces sort of struggling with each other in Northeast Asia today. So that's sort of a short version of it.
Okay. So that is the general situation. Talk to us about the most recent developments. Most of the time, a carrier battle group operating off the, you know, in the vicinity of the Korean Peninsula is simply done. It's a matter of course. They support exercises. I won't even say freedom of navigation because that's really not much of an issue up there. But this seems to be different. Talk to us about the American response right now, and then I'd also be curious. How is the Pacific Rim reacting to the visit over the weekend of the man who runs China, with the man who runs the United States. So so if you could address those, the carrier battle group and then the last weekend's visit.
Okay, the carrier battle group, obviously there's only so much that an aircraft carrier, even two aircraft carriers, can do. But it can do something. But the real significance, as I see it, is really psychological, which is ultimately political. And that is to demonstrate that the United States, and particularly with this new administration, has run out of patience. What has happened for the last 25 years is America's really just been strung along. And except for really on one or two occasions, it's been quite willing to be strung along with this elusive prospect of negotiating their way out of trouble on the Korean Peninsula. And as I said, it's just there's a sense that everything has been tried. Diplomacy has been tried, negotiations. They've tried economic aid to North Korea. They've tried limited sanctions, actually. They've tried to get the Chinese to help. Nothing else has helped. Nothing has worked. And thus, the military option is at least on the table. And that's really what's being announced here with the aircraft carrier Carl Vinson going up there to the region. So it's best to think of it as a sign that the United States is now is considering all options and not just negotiations. Will it actually do anything? That's anyone's guess. One would note North Korea is a big country, and one aircraft carrier, two aircraft carriers can only do so much. But think of it as a psychological, political move as much as anything. Regarding President Xi's visit to meet Mr. Trump in Florida, best way, I think, to look at this in terms of an Asian perspective is that most of Asia, except perhaps Cambodia and maybe Laos, does not want to be dominated by China. And they are very anxious, nervous, is that Mr. Trump was going to actually cut a deal with President Xi and somehow give the Chinese freer rein in Asia in exchange for some sort of concession. So one knows that Mr. Trump did not do this at all. And you would characterize most Asian countries as sort of looking on nervously and not being willing to say much for fear that somehow the Americans and the Chinese do cut a deal, and then they would be faced with dealing with China on their own. There isn't a single Asian country which on its own could handle the growing might and power and influence of China. So they're watching nervously, and I think they liked what they saw, but it's really just one instance, one event. Once you go down the list of countries from Korea to Taiwan, even to the Philippines, despite its current leader, right, down to Indonesia, Singapore, Malaysia, everybody is watching nervously and hopefully that the Americans will finally stand up and for once say no to China, but also improve and increase U.S. military presence and activity in the region, which once again, in many respects, have a huge psychological importance to them in demonstrating that there is some alternative to this inevitable sort of into inevitably being crushed by an expanding China.
Okay, I want to talk, I want to shift gears with you, and we'll kind of follow along the same thing. So that's for everybody listening, that's the general situation in the Pacific Rim. So there's a little bit of a refresher course, and then brought up to snuff on the dynamic of this past weekend. A shooting war between the United States, South Korea, and North Korea. This morning, Reuters is reporting that North Korean state media on Tuesday warned of a nuclear attack on the United States at any sign of U.S. aggression as a U.S. Navy or strike group steamed towards the Western Pacific. So this obviously, and I'll quote, our revolutionary strong army is keenly watching every move by enemy elements with our nuclear site focused on the U.S. invasionary bases, not only in South Korea and the Pacific Operational Theater, but also in, on the U.S. mainland. Also on the U.S. mainland. So the, certainly the rhetoric is present, as one might expect. A shooting war with the North Koreans. Let's just say it came to that. The United States said we won't live with this, and we're going to take decisive action to eliminate this. What happens in a shooting war between the United States, South Korea, and North Korea?
It would be sort of a god-awful mess. I think there is, these days in some quarters, there is a belief that all you do is you punch grid coordinates into cruise missiles, you launch the cruise missiles, and shortly afterwards your problems are solved. That's unlikely to happen. It doesn't really happen anywhere.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think we've been cured of that false. We've tried that a couple times, I think, and it doesn't work very well.
You'd be surprised how long-lived that belief is, and it's still around in a lot of quarters. But I think this would not be short, and it wouldn't be easy. And with all wars, it would be unpredictable. There would be twists and turns, and they'd be bloody and costly wherever they led. And what you would, certainly some of the immediate things that one could expect is certainly a very heavy air assault against all the targets that that anyone can find in North Korea that are of value. But it's worth keeping in mind that as good as our targeteers are, they rarely catch everything or spot everything, much less can hit it. One thinks back, it was 20 years ago, to Kosovo, where once a ceasefire was signed, the Serbians drove about 90% of their armored force out of Serbia, although the United States Air Force had destroyed it several times over, it was thought. The point is that you always miss something. And even in North Korea has had 60 years to build up some fairly formidable resources. Their military does have some problems. It's short of fuel in particular. The population writ large in North Korea, even the army, is malnourished owing to just constant food shortages. So it does have some problems, but in a sort of spasm of violence, paroxysm, it could cause some immediate harm to South Korea. Because you've got something like 14,000 missile tubes within easy, or artillery tubes within easy range of Seoul, the capital, that you've got missile forces which are capable of doing some damage, and you have North Korean special forces and units and suicide squads that have been training for nothing but to get loose into South Korea. And they can cause a lot of trouble. And just the North Korean military, just the size of it, it could sort of push south for a bit. It would get hammered and really have a lot of trouble before too long. But in this process, it would just be very damaging to South Korea. And particularly, keep in mind that Seoul is densely populated. Millions of people, and it's also a business center. It's an economic hub. It's a first world economy. So one thing we've never seen in a potential war on the North Korea, and we haven't seen this for decades, is the possibility of first world economies getting involved directly in fighting, in suffering damage. So the South Korean economy would be jolted, not to mention the South Korean society. And expect as well Japan to be hit, either with missiles, suicide squads. You could have commandos landing, coming ashore. You've probably already got some sleeper cells in place. If a South North Korean submarine gets loose, but Japan is quite likely to be in the fight, and they haven't really thought that through or exactly what they will do. And once again, Japan is a very important first world economy. The Chinese economy is a first world one as well, and that is not going to react so well to a major fight, a major conflagration on the Korean Peninsula. And all of these economies are linked to the global economy. So in addition to sort of the military problem that you have, you've also got the potential for considerable economic disruption globally. Now, if you want to see a stock market go down a few thousand points in a minute, just wait till the first round, the first shot is fired on the Korean Peninsula. So I don't see this as being short or easy or simple. And there really is no there is no sort of easy way to finish it. And I would suggest that if America starts something, it will need to be prepared to finish it. And I'm not sure that everyone has thought this through, other than the military. I'm not at all opposed to using military force if that is the only option in a this particular case. I wish they would try. America would play out, would think things through to the finish, and also if it would actually consider whether it has played all its cards yet, because it has not. And I'm specifically referring to the application of some real sanctions against North Korea. America has never done this.
All right. I want to talk about sanctions, and I want to talk about if there was going to be a shooting war, and let's just say this is all rhetoric. What are the other pieces that we would see prior to the beginning of a shooting war? So let me ask you those questions first, and then I want to talk about additional sanctions. Because it doesn't seem like – it seems like North Korea has done outside of every fence that's ever been built in the world, that they simply aren't part of the world of nations. And so I'm curious about the sanctions piece. But let me ask you militarily, since we've been developing kind of that point. Does the United States need additional ground forces in Korea – if there was to be a preemptive strike in order to sustain South Korea, would we see additional forces moving into South Korea?
I would say that normally you would, unless there is a belief, as there often seems to be, that everything can be done by air, either air-launched or missiles, that sort, or cruise missiles, etc., which has never really worked well in practice, but the belief still it won't die, and there's still plenty of proponents of that on the U.S. side, that we just hammer them really hard using our sort of our good targeting technology and our weapons, and that will draw the North Koreans to their senses, and the problem will be solved for a while. There may be that supporters for that way of thinking, but in general, it would be safe to have some more ground troops in South Korea, just to handle the potential threat from the north. What is currently in South Korea is not enough. If the north should roll the dice and see what they can do, it's just not enough. And if you're going to move U.S. forces to the peninsula or to the region, that's going to be pretty obvious. And the press is going to pick up on it. So I'm just speaking as really a right. sort of outside observer. But I think you'd know if anything was being moved. And I think that in the event of a really serious fight or shoot up on the peninsula, you would want to have ground troops there. You would want more naval assets there as well. It could be these are all being moved by stealth, but I'm not sure of that. Right. Particularly ground troops are hard to move without people finding them. Right. If a ship leaves a port out sort of other than on its normal schedule, then that right. tends to make the San Diego Union Tribune front page, etc. So I just haven't seen a sign of that.
I got it. Grant Newsham is our guest. He wise on all things in the Pacific Rim. That's what we're talking about. How about, obviously, I think we would see an additional carrier battle group head to the region as well. I don't know which is the closest one, but that would take weeks to get there. So maybe not. Maybe you'd see aircraft get flown to Japan. Maybe you'd see additional aircraft get flown into South Korea, if not another carrier battle group. So certainly, I think relative to the United States military, you would see additional forces move to the Korean Peninsula prior to any type of offensive action or preemptive strike.
Yeah, one would think so.
And again, the premise of that, Grant, is what you described. The North Koreans have been preparing for this for an incredibly long time. And what they've done is they have so many targets that are capable of striking South Korea and inflicting incredible damage. And they've done that with the idea that we have to be able to survive a first strike and a first exchange in order for us to adequately guarantee our own defense. And they've worked very hard at that for a lot of years to be arrayed like that. And so it is not going to be a simple exchange of cruise missiles and then somebody's going to say, hey, I give up your right, we'll stop. It is going to be a violent, violent event with a lot of civilians caught. In the vicinity of Seoul, and Seoul right up, very, very close to the DMZ. So anyway, I just wanted to kind of paint a picture in terms of why this is not a simple exchange of missiles and then somebody quits.
Yes, this is not at all sending a few cruise missiles into Yemen. This is different, and we'll see how it plays out.
All right, talk to me about the idea of sanctions. I think a lot of people look at sanctions and think, God, haven't we tried everything already? Isn't that the reason that we're at this point here? And what is China going to deliver on now that they haven't been able to deliver on in the past, and why should we believe them? So take that up. Don't take it up as an analyst, if you will. Can you take it? Well, you can take it up as an analyst, but could you also take it up from the perspective of the South Koreans and the Japanese in terms of perspective relative to sanctions, and why should we put any faith in China?
Okay, when you look at sanctions from the Japanese and even the South Korean perspective, and by sanctions it means really cutting off the flow of goods, of supplies, but particularly cutting off the flow of money into and from North Korea. The concern, and on the U.S. side as well, the concern has always been, well, if we do too much of it, the North Koreans might get mad and they might do something. And that do something is basically attack South Korea. Now it's getting to the point, not quite there yet, where it could be the doing something involves shooting missiles and with nuclear weapons on the top of them. They haven't quite got to that point, but it's just an engineering problem. And the idea is, the hope here is that, well, if we just implement a certain amount of sanctions, we'll just squeeze them just enough to shape their behavior for the better. And we can calibrate how much their behavior changes by how much we put sanctions on. And then we can also offer the possibility of relaxing those sanctions in exchange for good behavior. It's pretty much like Robert McNamara's ideas for pressuring North Vietnam, and has worked just about as well. In short, it hasn't worked very well at all.
Right.
And it's the question of how do you deal with really a really angry, tantrum-ridden child, a two-year-old, and sanctions are one tool to use, and we just have not, the United States and its partners have never implemented effective sanctions except in one case back in 2005. But otherwise, and you would think, well, how could it be that a country like North Korea does not face any real serious sanctions? And it is beyond belief. There are sanctions on things, say most recently on coal exports from China, or from North Korea to China. But China has never more than half-heartedly cooperated in any sanctions against North Korea. And effectively, it's China that has kept North Korea alive economically. There's different excuses which are trotted out. One is, well, they don't want to deal with North Korean refugees. They don't want chaos that would come from a North Korean regime collapse, etc. But it could just be that China is very happy to have a North Korea that distracts attention from the South Koreans and the Japanese and the Americans. I've really never seen any evidence that China is going to cooperate in a serious sanction regime against North Korea, even though its people have been promising it for 25 years. Successive American administrations have acted as if China really is serious about helping them with North Korea. So I would say where we've gotten to today on the Korean Peninsula has been a bipartisan achievement of several different administrations. But as I mentioned, those sanctions really have never been tried in any effective way. I'd mentioned an incident back in 2005, which really demonstrated the possibilities for serious sanctions against North Korea.
Grant Newsham, you know what? I guess I would tell you that I don't want to say I'm jaw-droppingly surprised, but I'm a bit surprised because if you asked me, I would tell you that I thought that we had attempted to contact sanction North Korea, and that had been tried already. Now I will tell you that I never thought that China participated in any of that, and so it would be new if China decided to participate. I'm somewhat surprised that this hasn't occurred. So give me your sense. Do you believe, have you seen any indication that China has changed? The lack of a reaction from China, they've been relatively quiet. At least I haven't seen any major story coming out of China commenting on North Korea. And the only story I did see was that they've moved 150,000 troops to the Yalu River to control refugees should anything happen in Korea. I'm curious about those two pieces. Do you think that China, have you seen any indication that China will change it soon and attempt to either lean harder on North Korea or if, in fact, as some have contested, that they don't have the influence that we think they do, they will join Japan, South Korea, the United States, and other Pacific nations and sanction in a real way North Korea?
I'm skeptical. I've never seen any indication that China has helped us with North Korea. But it is held out there as a lure to really shape our behavior. I just haven't seen the evidence for that, really not one shred of evidence. That story about moving 150,000 troops to the border, it's questionable. But once again, this belief that China is going to save us and bring North Korea to heel, I've not seen any indication it's accurate. And China could. They could, with really economically squeezing North Korea, the game would be over very shortly.
Really?
So they do have that kind of leverage. The one thing to keep in mind is that sanctions have been applied and are still in place against North Korea, but they've suffered from two main problems. One, they've been too narrowly focused. The Chinese have never more than half-heartedly enforced them. So there's always been a huge amount of trade which continues with North Korea despite sanctions, despite promises of the various countries to enforce them. One unbelievable example is the ongoing, steady, constant flow of luxury goods that are only for the benefit of the Kim regime and its cronies. That has been going on forever, pretty much unstopped. There's been a huge number of amount of illicit activities that the North Korean regime does overseas, drug dealing, counterfeiting, etc., to make them money. That have never been seriously cracked down on by anybody, not even the U.S. With all its resources. And then there's really the quite licit activities that you got a whiff of in Malaysia the other week, where you start got some attention, where you have North Korean, you have restaurants that North Koreans run. There's about 50,000 to 100,000 North Koreans who work overseas. In forced labor, in Europe, the Middle East, China, Russia, in things like mining, logging, the textile industry, construction, and they don't live very well. Their money, their pay goes directly to the North Korean government. And this would be as if the Russian gulag back in the Soviet Union days had sent inmates overseas to earn money for the Kremlin elite. So you've got this combination of just ongoing activity that earns the regime money that keeps it alive, just as a criminal gang needs money to stay alive. And this has never been seriously cracked down on, and it's the U.S. that has to really take the lead, and they've never done it for some reason that I don't understand. And now here we are talking about war, before we've actually tried a real effort with sanctions against North Korea, and like we did for a short while in 2005, 2006, that were the most effective things the Americans have ever done against North Korea since the Incheon landing. So there, that's your Bill O'Reilly and Al Sharpton.
For those of you who don't know, that was part of the Korean War. And so it's been a few years. My guest, Grant Newsham, former United States Marine Corps intel officer, been serving in the Pacific. What was your? How old were you when you made your first trip to Japan, Grant?
Well, oh goodness, I was fairly old actually. I was probably like 28 or so.
Wow, that is old. I mean, to go there, the Japanese perspective in all of this. Is what nervous anticipation? Korea, as you pointed out, an uneasy relationship between the two of them. Japan, I'm sure, would like it to be better, but the scars from the colonial experience in World War II are still remain and are still political considerations for the South Koreans. What is Japan's perspective in all of this?
They're, put it mildly, worried. I think one way to compare it is suppose, say, that Mexico had sort of a pretty good missiles, was building nuclear weapons, and was threatening America. That's pretty close by. And Japan has always been very worried about North Korea. But the worries have just gotten worse and worse on the line as North Korean missile technology and missile abilities my capabilities have improved, and there really is an immediacy to Japanese concerns. Once again, from missile attack, from Korean special forces getting loose in Japan, from floods of refugees headed into Japan, interruption in trade. They're very worried, but they have never really developed sort of an adequate defense for it against the North threat from the North. And as a result, they ultimately depended on the United States to help them out and to save them. Japan is trying to do more with its military now, but it hasn't on its own. It would be would have some problems. It's done things, for example, like it's bought Patriot missiles to deal with at least part of the North Korean missile threat. They haven't perhaps bought as many of spare missiles as they might have, but that's the Japanese approach to things. But they are indeed very worried, and there's even a widespread talk in the Japanese administration, the political world, and people who think about these things, that maybe Japan needs its own, they call it, strike capability or something like that. Basically means maybe they should have their own missile forces to be able to eliminate a threat from North Korea. And this has been talked about for probably 5 or 6 years now, but it's getting more and more attention. I'm not sure that the Japanese side quite understands everything that's involved, in that. And there is a belief that just having some very accurate missiles that you can target them, send them on their way, and thus solve your problem easily. That belief is still widespread, really, in Japan, Japanese government circles. There's a few people who understand what's really required, but not everybody. So Japan really is worried by all of this because and North Korea says all the time that they're going to attack Japan, make Japan pay for this or for that. So there is a lot of worry. If you went to Japan, of course, as a visitor, you wouldn't notice it. But in Japanese government circles, there is a lot of concern here. The Japanese-Korea relationship has always been stressed or strained, as we mentioned. But the Japanese would love to be good friends with the South Koreans. But that's not Koreans don't respond quite the same way. Although the relation on a person-to-person relationship, the relationship can be very good. But in general, it is strained. There's also about probably somewhere up close to about a million Korean Japanese who live in Japan. They came over mostly during the colonial era, not always by choice, but sometimes by choice. So there is actually a Korean Japanese part of the population, which has some influence, not a whole lot, but it is an influence that one notes.
Grant Newsham, our guest. Grant is a senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies in Tokyo. And Grant, I hear that, and I'm going to read you an email that kind of alludes to something we spoke with earlier. I don't know if you know retired Marine Corps Brigadier General Tom Droughty, but you may. He was on earlier in the program, and we were discussing, and I'll read the email because it alludes to it. Hey, Mac, I'm curious how the Japanese see their own defense in the Western Pacific. They have North Korea very close to them. They have China close to them. China is expanding. A bit ago, when General Droughty was on, you talked about the atrophy of NATO and then the message that sends in terms of sustaining peace, and normally the way you do that is you do that through strength. It seems to me this the Pacific alliance has atrophied as well, in that you have Japan constitutionally limited from having a large army, and then it seems like nations like Taiwan and Australia have allowed their militaries to atrophy as well. I'm curious about Grant's thoughts on this, and because it seems to me, just like in Europe with Putin marauding around and acting like a gangster, you have similar behavior in the Western Pacific, which would be easily deterred by the United States, Australia, Japan, Taiwan, and South Korea standing together, and they say, hey, we will not allow that. Why doesn't this happen? Grant's thoughts on it. So the atrophy of many nations' ability or desire to defend themselves, Grant, your thoughts on it.
Sure. By the way, I've met General Droughty a couple of times. He's a good guy. He knows what he's talking about. The atrophy idea, that's actually accurate. It, of course, manifests itself a bit differently from between Europe and Asia, but the basic idea, that's basically correct, that the almost all of these nations, except perhaps Australia, which is really so small, have allowed their militaries to develop in ways that don't make sense. This sort of stunted growth. They can do the wrong things, and they can't do the right things that they need to do. For example, they have huge ground forces in a lot of cases, but they can't do amphibious operations. They've got high-end aircraft, but they don't face any real threat. So there is a sort of a huge military atrophy or problem or imbalance in Asia. Just taking the Japanese, however, as one example, it's I think part of the, I think compared to some of our NATO allies, they actually have been very aggressive and supportive in building their defense. I'd say by comparison, they do have a really good-sized military with some good hardware, but it has not really been ever been structured or even forced to be able to operate in joint operations, combining air, sea, and ground. That's a really an effective military needs to do. And I think the a main reason for this is the pathologic dependence on the United States for the last 60 years, where there was always a belief that, well, the Americans will take care of everything. We just have to do enough to be able to do a few things, but ultimately make it look to the Americans like we're doing something. That's a little cynical, but not entirely far off. And that pathologic dependence, what it means is that Japan has never felt forced to develop the capabilities and the ability to use the weapons they have in an effective way. And because you can always count on the Americans to backstop you, to the Americans to have the essential equipment that's necessary. And that pathologic dependence is never a helpful, healthy thing in any relationship, in foreign affairs or even personal relations, I would say. Plus, the Japanese have never spent enough on defense. They spend more than most NATO allies, which is, you know, to their credit, but they just don't spend enough. They've underspent by tens of billions each year for probably 50, 60 years. I would estimate that Japan probably gets $25 billion in free defense services from the United States every year. They have been for decades, and one gets used to that. But it's manifesting itself today in a Japanese defense force, which is only partially effective. Korea has had some problems, some similar problems in terms of overdependence on the United States. But, you know, the dynamic, the circumstances are a bit different with the South Koreans. And through all of this, though, the Americans have really been quite happy to just take on, to do everything if necessary. And that worked until there was a real threat in the region, which there wasn't until about 20 years ago when China started to build up. And this idea that, well, the Americans will take care of everything, it's something we were, it seemed, glad to do, that just doesn't work anymore. And then you go down the line and just go down country to country, and you will find that that every military there has some serious shortcomings, either in terms of size, sort of the modern weapons, and the ability to use them. And this is not even talking about the political willingness to use them. General Draghi were to go visit the Taiwan Marine Corps at their headquarters, he would feel as though he had walked into onto a Marine Corps base in about 1959. That's how familiar it all is. And it's also just how it hasn't changed into a lighter, more maneuverable, flexible force. But that's just one example from Taiwan. But you go down, and throughout the region, the militaries have been imperfectly developed. And once again, Australia is something of an exception. But once again, it just doesn't have the size or the scale to be that effective. But it's a very useful bunch to have around in any sort of situation. And so there really has never been an Asian NATO. And one would suggest that it'd be very hard to see something like that happening. But ultimately, it's what really is essential is that the United States has got to take the lead if it wants to remain a force in Asia. It's got to take the lead bringing together these disparate militaries into some sort of loose, at least cooperative agreement. That it doesn't even have to be spoken. It just has to be understood and every now and then do something useful. And a structure for that could easily be the United States, Japan, India, if you could bring them in, and Australia into the mix, and South Korea where it can. Vietnam could play a useful role. Taiwan, if we were to ever pay it some attention that it deserves, they could be very useful. Indonesia could play a niche role, Singapore as well. But it does take some imagination on the U.S. side to make this happen. And I'm not sure that I've seen much interest in that on the U.S. side. There is, in some ways, a preference just for doing exercises and going around the region, flexing our muscles and putting on a Harlem Globetrotters show. But really has not produced many concrete results in creating something of that sort of informal cooperative alliance that I just described. But that really is essential. There's a lot to work with if we were to make the effort to do that. It would be nice to see some imaginative types of whom we have plenty being given the rein and the freedom to go, quote, figure it out.
Grant, first of all, I know it's early in Hawaii, so I want to thank you for getting up and doing this. The issue is a complex one, and you come on and you do a great job in kind of putting that mosaic together in a way that we can understand that. I've got one more email question, and then I will let you go. Mac, first of all, I love when Grant comes on. He is great relative to explaining what goes on out there. And to be honest with you, every time I see his name, I make sure I listen. You should listen anyway. What the hell? My question for him is this. What does he expect to happen next? Is this a grand game of posturing that we see? Or is there something more real that is bound to happen? I know the whole world is watching and wondering. What does Grant expect to see next?
I predict Redskins Super Bowl victories every year, so you can probably
take it with a grain of salt.
I think that it's going to get worse and worse and worse in Asia. Not that it's going to be a hellish place just yet, but this is not going to resolve itself. Even if you took North Korea out of the mix, you would still have a China which is militarizing very nicely, quickly, rapidly, and its stated intention is to push the United States out of the region. So the United States either gets pushed out or it asserts its interests, and that could potentially cause some friction, will cause a lot of friction. There will be a lot of bluster and threats from China, and I hope we haven't waited too long before pushing back. So I would expect that relationship to be strained. The Chinese are going to make a move in the East China Sea at some point to teach the Japanese a lesson and also to pick off a little bit of Japanese territory. I would expect that to happen. As for the Korean Peninsula, as noted, at this point it's really just an engineering question unless before North Korea gets the missiles and nuclear weapons that will go where they want them to go, anywhere on the globe. And no matter what administration it is in the United States, they have to make the very, very difficult decision as to do you live with that or do you do something about it. I think we've probably never been closer to having an administration, but also people outside of the administration in the U.S. who are willing to at least contemplate doing something about it. One has always heard that, well, the possibility of war on the Korean Peninsula is just unthinkable.
Right.
North Korea wouldn't do it, and we wouldn't get involved just because it's too just unthinkable. Well, it is thinkable, and we're going to have to deal with that probably sooner rather than later. So the region is not going to become as nice and placid as Bermuda anytime soon. But I think it is going to get awfully interesting, and I think it is probably going to get pretty rough in the near term.
All right. Well, Grant, again, appreciate you always getting up early for us, and I hope you don't mind as these events unfold. One of the first calls you'll get will be from me, and continue to come on and make us smart. So thank you very much.
Sure, it's my pleasure. Anytime.
All right, that is Grant Newsham, a great friend of the All Warrior Radio Network, and my thanks to him for coming on this morning. So again, not only coming on is the easy part, getting up. I want to say it was 5 o'clock in Hawaii. So very gracious of him to do that. So, with all of that said, we're going to take a quick break. The Gunner joins us next on a Tuesday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.